Culture Eats Strategy for Lunch. An informed culture's drive decisions inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data.
And I'm Lee Harper, AI human, with over a decade doing AI and data science bits and pieces. And today we're joined by Keetra Nesbitt. She is a principal solutions engineer at Valkyrie, based here in Austin, Texas. Welcome, Keetra. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit more to the listeners?
Yeah, thanks so much, you guys, for having me. Denver native, been in Austin for 9 years, though. And I'm just excited to chat with you guys about what I've been able to see at Valkyrie over my past 5 years and just different learnings.
And so, Keetra, you are joining us again. This is not your first rodeo with us. So we had a very awesome summer panel around all topics AI. What does it mean to have? What are different organizational models for successful delivery? Today's conversation is going to build on that. With you working at Valkyrie, you see a lot of different cultures, a lot of different both successes and failures. So we got some key questions and things to walk through, everything from how do you define success for AI initiatives to how do you create those virtuous cycles? And then one of the points that you proposed that I really love is it's kind of the working backwards. How do I think about, you know, the white paper on the successes I had? So where would you like to start? I know defining is probably the biggest thing. So if you were going to think about how do you recommend clients define success? Where have you started with those things?
Yeah. So I think before you define the success, I think you have to clearly identify the problem and really a business problem. You have a business that provides a service or gives a product. What is it that you do? And then where are there gaps? Where are there inefficiencies? What is something you're trying to solve? And then what are the KPIs that are connected to that business problem? If you have a hard time staffing projects quickly or just a hard time staffing them, what are the KPIs? The time to staff, the quality of the resources that are staffed, the productivity of the project once they are staffed, right? So then you've identified these are all of the KPIs that are connected to that business problem. So then as you build your AI solution, you're tracking it, you know, one, what KPIs directly should I track? But those are long-term goals, right? And you want to set that out. But usually that short-term, okay, you guys built me something. Where am I seeing this impact?
Yeah.
Those are harder, but more still important to see, right? Because sometimes it's not just about, well, how well did the model predict this value? What is the quality of the output that you're getting? Are there people who are spending less time on a task because of this solution? Are you just making decisions faster? Are you making decisions easier because you're now more informed before you need to make that decision? So defining that success in the long term, it looks like, what's the problem? What are the KPIs that are related to this?
Yep.
But in the short term, it is a little more qualitative and tactical of how does it change people's lives right now or their work that they're doing? And where are we seeing just some tangible small wins?
How often, or do you have a lot of customers that you work with where you have to help them separate like those bigger kind of lagging indicators, like our KPIs, like the company metrics usually tend to be those lagging indicators. What was revenue? What was margin? What was customer sat? All that happened after the fact. So when you're talking about traction and knowing, hey, I picked a problem, it's got a big lagging indicator attached to it. So how often do you have to coach folks through what are leading indicators that tell us we're towards solving?
Oh, most of the time. And it's just trying to really help our clients understand. One, first, I think the results, like, what are you going to actually get from this model? And is this just a proof of concept that we're building for you? Is this just going to give you some basic analytics? Is this a full V1 product that we've built? Most of the time, not. You're starting off at that proof of concept or MVP. And so understanding, now that you have this MVP model, these are the kind of results you're going to get. Also being able to tie which will impact this, which then leads up to the higher KPI. So we generally do have to draw that through line for them. And I think that any company who wants to, you know, either they're doing data science internally or they're bringing on a client, they want to have someone that can help them draw those lines. They want to have not just a data science partner, but someone who also has a strategic eye set and can help them make that connection between this is what we're going to build for you. This is what we're going to deliver. These are the expected results. And these are how the results start to tie. Maybe not directly. There's probably a couple of levels to the bigger KPI that people want to track.
Okay. So then trick question, are you part of the strategy group or the science group?
Just, I know it's hard. Then people are like, I am a strategic scientist, just a 50-50.
Yeah. So you still have feet in both. And sorry, everyone, the joke is, as Keacher and I were talking prior to this call, I get invited to both parties and to both book clubs because people aren't sure of which group. Am I in the strategy group or am I in the science group? And it depends. You're the double agent, basically, is what we're...
Yes.
You are the double agent.
So related question, it's most data science folks are very bad at converting their statistical KPIs, precision, recall, F1, ad nauseum, into business metrics. My stakeholder doesn't care about what my F1 score is. They do care about how much money they'll make or how much quicker something will happen or how much many few errors people are going to make. How do you go about bridging that gap between the scientists and their KPIs and the stakeholders and the business and their KPIs, which are often quite different?
Absolutely. Really good question, Lee. And it's just, it is funny because that is very much how the scientist is. They're like, this is how well my model's performing and it's doing this. And you're like, and I'm like, okay, that's great. And then I'm like, that doesn't tie to the business. So it's thinking about the work process and the business flow. Okay, you built a model that is going to recommend the right resources for different projects. And so you start to think about what is that current process like? How do they currently figure out who should go on a project? How much time and resources and money is it going to take? Who is involved in doing that? How many people? What happens if there are errors? And then I start thinking about, okay, so now that you guys have developed this model, what happens if, how well are you tracking? How soon can someone get that information? Is it the same day that they can put in the project information and you highlight? Is it going to give them suggestions? Is the human still involved? So I really start to match what is the current just workflow and process and how has that now changed with the model? So I can start to identify, ooh, there is a time that got shortened. Ooh, they actually didn't know that information before. And now we are including that information. So they're going to be more informed. And it's starting to compare how the process was changed to identify, okay, there was something that helped towards the bigger operations KPI.
And if I may, I'm going to tie that, like one thing you just said there about how the operations changed to like your second point on creating virtuous cycles. Because maybe it's just our clients and you just have perfect clients, but maybe we have clients that have just need similar amounts of help and similar amounts of guidance. But when you do a model or any of these things, we're inherently or should be seeking change, seeking improvement. So you might model the flow on either this process that you're trying to help people either be more informed, act faster, any number of things. Yeah. But then you should also be seeking for that to change because you change behavior when you push something through, you change capability when you push something through. How have you used that to create like these virtuous cycles and the projects that y'all do?
When I first thought about this question, I was just thinking about like how can one AI or one data management change and kind of lead to your next project and build on. But I also get in your just standpoint of how can changing one workflow benefit a whole other workflow. So if I'm thinking of a client where there's personnel and then there's operations and there's finance, and it was three different groups, and personnel and operations work maybe a little bit closer than finance, but they can still be very like, no, this is my lane. And so it was when we change how personnel decides to staff these projects, then operations gets to have better performance on their projects. Finance is able to track how much are these certain projects costing and why is one project taking longer and costing more, and really just understanding that. And so it was, while a tool was built to help just one organization or one department be more efficient in one of their processes, it definitely blended into the other organizations, which is what you really want from your AI initiatives. You want an AI initiative that can create this kind of cycle and that can touch multiple departments to really see, hey, I'm changing my entire organization, instead of, hey, I just changed this one process over here and no one else is getting benefits from that.
On a related note to that, have you had scenarios? So because when we ask those questions, like you're proposing, so when we ask questions to look at like the impacts upstream and downstream, then we can also catch when there's negative impact. So I might do an improvement, local improvement, but that local improvement has negative global impacts. And they say local and global is in the context of like large, it, very common in large organizations. I optimize for something locally, but globally that causes across the org, it causes a lot of pain. So have you had to coach clients through making sure you're looking upstream, downstream to make sure it's not that they tried something and it went in inadvertently poorly that was bad. It's if you don't ask the questions and look, that's bad. Right.
Yeah. I can't think of an example, but we do conduct impact assessments on our projects to identify. And both ways, right? If our model does really well and people are adapting it and using it, what are the pros? And then also if it's poor or not correct, how does that also have a negative effect, and try to identify those areas and then be honest with clients saying, hey, just want to know if the model does this or this happens, if data starts trending this way, these are some negative consequences that you might see and should be aware of or look out. But that is a very good point that there may be situations and times where the effect is good locally, but then like globally, and it can be even probably enhanced processes, right? Because now it's, oh, maybe now there's more oversight because everyone is doing something locally. And then it's like, well, now everyone has to do that and makes a whole big reorg or change management policy because like one organization or one local spot doing it differently than the rest.
Probably we had a guest on, Jody Blumberg, a few months ago, and she was talking about, among other things, the once you build a model and get that virtuous cycle started, there's also the adoption cost, right? There's the model building part is only the first part of one's journey into the transformation. How, what have you done, or what kind of strategies do you employ to really help the adoption of these things among people that honestly couldn't care less about the machine learning? All they care about is their job has been made easier, becoming more productive, the things that matter to them. How do you ease that adoption among the users or stakeholders of this?
Definitely an important process and something to do. I believe usually we're brought in by either someone that's mid-level or sometimes the C-suite. So it's important to maintain the relationship with the C-suite. You want to maintain that motivation and that drive of, we have a leader, we have someone in the organization who is, you guys, we're doing this, right? But then you also want to have a really good relationship and understanding of the people who are the boots on the ground who are going to actually be using your tool, and that their jobs are changing. We want to have a good relationship. Can we really understand? We would love to come and watch you work and see how we're going to change your workflow, because you need buy-in from both people. You really, in order to continue that like cultural impact, you need the C-suite to back you, but you also need the people who are actually going to be using it to use it in order to create something, right? So it is strong relationships with the people. And then I think it is early conversations about that. It's early conversation about, what are your plans for change management? What have you communicated to your team about us coming in, about this new AI initiative, about, right, and really starting to understand what is the current culture around AI and new technologies? And then we can start to identify, hey, we created this educational deck where it sounds like people are a little unsure about what AI does, what machine learning is going to do, or what Valkyrie is. So then we're finding ways of educating people, and then as needed, advising on just different strategies, again, for our clients to employ. We don't think that change management should come from the AI consulting firm to come in and conduct this change management process now. But we're happy to work with our clients. Like, okay, let's identify what does that need to look like now that someone's job has changed or their process has changed because of this new tool. And again, hopefully that changed is improved, so it is their job is easier, is more informed, it's not replacing them, but just giving them a better tool to do their job quicker, better, easier.
Now, I heard some very important things that you mentioned there in these virtuous cycles, right? And so it's always, as you mentioned, like keeping eye and alignment on the goal, which then means then you have to look at, as you said, these impact assessments that you do, which is probably why when I was part of something years ago, and I was the recipient of it, I'll say that part. I was a recipient of that change, that local optimization that had a bad global impact. Had somebody then, when they were doing that change and planned that team and that group and everything, then they followed it all the way through, up and downstream. You could see the changes. You could see the impacts. Maybe it wouldn't be perfect, but you would also at least ask the questions and know to look before and after your group. Other things is like, hey, let's like focus on education. Make sure people understand the change is coming. As well as then, you know, I think it's funny. I think if we as like technology consultants always have to expect change management to be a part of something, even if we don't necessarily want to manage the change management ourselves, but yet to your points, do you want your AI consultant to do that, or do you want, or do you have the capability in-house for somebody else to do it? Like, that self-awareness is really important. How then, so if we have these virtuous cycles, you get the first change going on, you have a lot of like the qualitative skills that you and the team do as you're doing, bringing about this change. Mm-hmm. How are you identifying AI appropriate problems, right? Like, it's the old adage of the sledgehammer on the nail or the screw, right? This is,
yeah.
We're not going to have LLMs, like Lee likes to say, we're not going to have LLMs build forecasting models.
Yeah. Yeah. In the beginning, before we've actually seen their data, maybe we're hearing what are their problems. And we're at that point deciding like, is this in, and by AI, isn't this just a data problem, right? Because your clients usually don't know the difference between this is going to be statistical analysis or this machine learning algorithm or this is AI. But it's more of, does this sound like a software engineering problem? Want a better way of reading and scanning through these PDFs? And I don't really know if this is when we need a connector to do this from that. And it was like, that just sounds like a software engineering problem. I'm not confident that is solved by AI or solvable. So I think it's generally heard quickly. When we're creating opportunity roadmaps for clients, we do take their interviews and we're just really hearing what are your business problems? What are your pain points? What do you just hate doing in your job? What's the part that's the most tedious from you? Because usually that's what we're looking for is, okay, can we automate some tedious information? Can we make a process faster? Or what information do you wish you had when you need to make this decision that you don't? So it's more about the types of questions we ask to just stay in the right lane and not have people go, I don't know, far-fetched. I know. I was like, not quite sure that I felt that there was like a big red flag or issue about which problems do or don't need AI solutions, just because generally, like, we are steering the questions so much that we're like, we're not even going to let you go off the trail of something that's not
anyway. But are you introducing bias early on?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. All right.
So good on the business. That's
exactly.
Yeah. We could happily say, hey, we've heard this problem. You're going to need to hire someone to build a better chair. People don't like the chair. I don't know. It's not an AI problem.
Yeah. So what are some like AI overkill signs? And you're free to use real examples if you want. But that's why we have fun talking about Lee's example, the LLM to build a forecasting model. So what are some like classic overkill or things that you commonly see that might, to some of the untrained observers, right? So i.e. the execs, the business leaders, are like, they know how it can be useful. And they know there's a lot of utility that can be gained, but they're obviously not deep in the weeds.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's maybe I'll just tell the story of, hey, I wish that in a meeting, I could have someone just record, or it records all of my meetings and organizes my calendar based on what is said. And so I think for some of the, when I see, you know, AI overkill, I'm more always thinking from like a responsible AI standpoint. So then I will just be worried about, I don't know if we should be doing that. Do we need to put devices in every meeting room and capture all of this information? So I think for me, sometimes the overkill is also just on a data privacy, on a data governance standpoint of, sure, I am sure there is some technology that we could get together to do this task, but is it safe? Is it good? Is it helpful? Like, the harms don't outweigh, or the harms outweigh the pros. And so that may like back us away from being like, yeah, that's a good thing. Let's go and build that.
No, I think that's a great point that it does get frequently overlooked. I love that you brought that up because if we had all the data, I don't know how many people watch the Westworld series, right? The TV show. But when they were, I think it was the end of the second or the third season, I forget. But where one of the protagonists, the one that had Solomon, the big AI predictive devices that they had built, and was, they wanted all the behavioral data that Westworld had captured. That was the, as the data person was nerding out, I know exactly why you want that. To have all that recorded like telemetry data about what was going on in somebody's brain, no wonder you want that.
Yes.
But that's, we could obviously collect all the data of all the things, and that would be, I don't want that. Yeah.
So I think the overkill just comes from an overstep of, let's get AI to do this and then we can get something to do that. It's, that seems like we're getting really reachy out there. So let's take a step back. And again, and also I think sometimes it's that it's just a wish list item and it's not tied to an actual business problem. But when we work with these, our clients, they can be mid-market. And so some of the CEOs, they are young, they're entrepreneurs, they're visionaries, which is great. That's what you want in an entrepreneur, because they're going to be visionaries. But then I think sometimes it makes them just overdream in ways that start to get away from, is that actually going to change your, you want us to build you a robot to do like that? How's that relate to your business problem? Then we just start getting lost in that because they are just excited about AI and they're like, oh, and you guys could do this and then we could get that. So that is also something that is.
Oh, yeah. So it's like we're saying, identify AI appropriate problems. You can have two factors there. It's like you might actually start the conversation off of, as you're saying, something that was on your opportunity roadmap that's important, but then that can veer off because people, we started talking about this and wow, suddenly we're talking about like trash enabled robots that are going to also clean the cat litter, which I would love, by the way. But you know what? We are selling birthday cards. Okay. All right. They're not aligned. So yeah, having that, doing that step that y'all do, the opportunity rep, and I cannot believe we haven't talked about that because that's actually what we call it, the problem and opportunity roadmap. Nice. That's it. So if you call it the opportunity roadmap. So by the way, everybody listening, we did not discuss that beforehand. Just so happens that we actually do. Sometimes we can think smart things that other people think too. but yeah, I bet having that opportunity roadmap is useful for anchoring those discussions when they go far afield.
It's also backed by, we actually heard this problem or someone said in an interview, that's also really helpful and not just, we have a wild idea. But
yeah. Okay. So then going into like when you do the impact assessments and other things like that, going into these discussions, you've already got the roadmap, but that's backed by, as you're saying, lots of interviews to like, what is executive viewpoint, but also what are boots on the ground? What do they have as well?
Yeah. So our impact assessment is very tied to just a singular AI initiative. Mm-hmm. Okay. You want to forecast revenue. And we'll do an impact assessment, identifying everyone in your ecosystem by forecasting this revenue. What are the effects downstream, upstream for good and bad outcomes?
Yeah.
And then the opportunity roadmap is, okay, sure, you want to forecast or you want to forecast revenue. What else is there ways that we could impact, use AI, or what are other data initiatives across your organization that we could, that we've identified based on interviews? There's also people who want to be able to forecast just other information. So those are the, I know there is a lot of similar industry names. So I just wanted to say we are using similar names, but the impact assessment is just for one singular initiative.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I realized like earlier in my career, I realized I need to be better about making sure to frame names for things. Years ago, we came up with our data warehousing and analytics methodology. So it's like 12, 15 years ago now, but we called it A3, Agile, Accurate, and Accelerated. And so I gave this whole session one time to the Microsoft offices talking about all this stuff. And one person who happened to come from lean world complained, I thought you were talking about A3 problem solving. I had to go look it up. Oh, crap. There is actually a whole
thing. I thought you were referring to page sizes because in the UK, A3 is a paper.
Oh, right. It's not just the UK. Like my printer back there will actually say, hey, you want A3, A4, or all these different things. But yes. But yeah, exactly, right? If we were talking to a print publisher or like somebody like that, like back to Keacher's birthday card company. So this would be, paper size would mean something. But yeah, that it's naming and framing things is really important. I guess one last question I had on the identifying AI appropriate problems. So you have your opportunity roadmap, which helps keep focus on why things need to be solved and what should we do. How can organizations realign once they've realized they've made a mistake on either problem selection or the AI methods and techniques they want to use to solve the problem?
You know, that it's like the first piece of advice is like a lot of times initiatives fail because there was a misunderstanding or miscommunication about what the business problem is and what they thought the data initiative, the modeling would be able to give them. Was part of, okay, really in the beginning, try to make sure that you're clear, reiterating, you're educating. Again, educating on, hey, very technical to non-technical stakeholders, what it is. But again, let's say that they've already made that mistake and they're like, hey, this actually isn't what we need. Then I think, I don't know, you're just going to have to be patient. I think if you have a partner who's able to recognize, okay, you wanted a forecast at an hourly limit. We built something that was at a daily limit. No worries. We can realign this data. We can reconfigure. We now better understand your business problem and how you build schedules at an hourly cadence and not on daily cadence. So trying to get them to realign really just takes patience and time because it's once you're communicating clear and you really, your data partner hopefully has built their solution in such a way of modular that they can make these types of changes, but it would still take time. So I think it's like, communicate really clearly what it is that you needed from that business goal. And then, okay, now I've got now giving your data partner this time for them to go and edit. But
given that, given that AI is so data dependent, have you ever had situations, because I certainly have, where you get in and the data is just so appalling for some reason? So I had a case where there was manually input data of temperature. Some of them use Celsius, some use Fahrenheit, some use Kelvin. They had, you know, different levels of decimal places in all cases. And there was just no easy way to tell what was what. So we had to just tell them, hey, that I'm afraid not, go and fix your data first. Have you ever had any kind of things like that happen on things that you've had to work or see?
I don't think it has happened on any of my projects, but I have had our chief science officer need to go in and say, okay, hey, we always have an EDA session, right? So we're doing our exploratory data analysis. We're looking at the data. We know what we're supposed to build or predict. And then we're not going to be able to based on the data that you've given us. And so she'll kindly come in and she has a nice reframe of being like, this is what your data looks like now. This is what we can do, right? So it's a very soft, originally we were going to build a model to do this. Based on your data, the shape of it, what you actually collect, we'll be able to do this, and maybe walking them through why there's that kind of step of your data just isn't there to tell you that story that you're looking for, make that prediction, provide those recommendations, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then some recommendations on if you start collecting this type of data, then maybe that model you actually thought you could build and that was in your data.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing you just said there, as once you realize either through it's the EDA, but even maybe the initial EDA still supports you pursuing. And then once you get into it, you realize, oh, there's some other things that happened that a short week worth of EDA wouldn't have uncovered, right? Which still happens, right? So I think that, as you were just saying there, it's like helping reframe the win, which is, okay, you learn more about your business. Now you have to determine, is this a problem worth solving? I.e., is the outcome we were shooting for by going after this data, this model, anything still worth going? So because now we're further informed on the cost to pursue it. We have to make this change in the business, make this change in this app, make this change in this process so that the data is useful for the purposes we now want to do. You thought it was going to be XYZ cost to do it. It's going to be XYZ plus some factor now. Mm-hmm. But it still could be that's the return in doing so is big enough. Sometimes not, but a lot of times it can be.
I did just remember an example. It was a project I was on. We were, again, predicting. We've seen a lot of resource prediction or, hey, what should be staffed on this information? And they wanted to use the manager's evaluation as, is this person quality enough to fit this type of project?
Okay.
And again, I don't know, like, how by the time we vigorized, we're like, the managers just give the same middle of the road evaluation. There's not a lot of diversity in that data point. Everybody is a 5, so it's out of 10. And so we're like, that's not giving a lot of noise. And there would occasionally be like, okay, if they got a 1, they clearly must have been like annoying, because it's like, or a 3, if everyone gets a 5, then, and if someone got a 3, that maybe really does signal something, because they couldn't just get the general 5 that everyone gets. But it was just, hey, again, informing them, I don't know if you guys know this or not, maybe you need to change a process of how often managers evaluate and the quality at which they actually are evaluating. Is it that they have to evaluate people that they really haven't seen their work, and that's why they just give them these middle of the road 5s? But then it was, what we can do is we'll still predict this value and we will just show you what the last evaluation was. So you'll have that information. You're probably going to see a lot of 5s. So it was, I think, it was further down. It was after EDA when we discovered this. And so that was, the client was pretty upset about that, of like, you guys should have found this earlier. And we were like, yes, sorry.
Yeah.
But it also really did inform just a whole business process and culture shift that needed to change, because you really wanted to use a data point to be more efficient in something. And the way that people are creating that data point was low quality.
Might wonder why their HR department hadn't noticed that beforehand, right? But I think on one hand, people complain, like data people in the data space complain a lot. It's like, why didn't you notice that before? Why didn't you see that? Like the client, right? Like not necessarily us coming in after the fact, but like our people will complain about why didn't the client look at this? And so there's a lot of stuff to look at. So what is the importance and the value in looking at that? And so I think people usually have to be anchored to it. So it's like here, if they were all 3s, or like a place Lee and I worked at, first worked at together, it would be like all 5s. right? Like people were afraid to put anything negative about anybody. So it's, oh, you're awesome. You walk on the moon, like all this other stuff. No, not everybody can.
Yeah.
So what does that say about if you want a company that has like people who are constantly improving and progressing, that means constructive criticism feedback has to be given. I take the perspective like people are very busy and we're only going to pay attention to the things that are very important to us. If we're saying improvement of the people isn't important, then maybe that's why your data isn't very good.
Yeah.
Because like by habits, patterns, and practices, you're saying it's not important. So we said it like at the company Lee and I first, like it was important, but then the use of that information wasn't important. And so therefore it wasn't valued. And so then there was just not very good data in their performance feedbacks because it was all sunshine and roses.
And clearly like this data is like, it's never been used before because no one else has ever recognized why does everyone get this evaluation score?
My favorite one is mechanics in car workshops, right? They love fixing cars. They hate data entry. So what do? They always pick the first option in a lot of the drop-down lists. So yeah, every service is a 10,000 mile service. Had that before.
Because it's the first one to choose.
It's the first one.
They want to fix more cars. They don't want to input data. Oh. So
then as you go, so the ways that you try to help, one, define success, create these virtuous cycles, identify AI appropriate problems. So say you have these opportunity roadmaps, digging in, making sure to tie to business benefit. Then, so as we've talked on the last podcast and our LinkedIn live sessions, like framing the problem is really important. But as people start to build those strategies, and when you have come in and either, so maybe they internally built a strategy or you're coming in for after another consulting company, what are common pitfalls that you see in those strategies?
Yeah, as I said, I think there can be a misunderstanding of what the AI solution is going to solve, what is it to do. And so I think that there's a lot of due diligence on explaining that, because if the business executive is, oh my gosh, they're going to be able to, you know, forecast this and it's going to change that. And it's, oh, actually what we're forecasting is something that's two steps down revenue or only one type of revenue, but they think, you know, big, then they're less likely to continue it. As soon as the contract ends, you lost that C-suite's motivation and that desire for this initiative to continue on the success. As we've just said, if the data isn't there, they really want a model to predict something. And then we go through their data and we're like, you know, you don't have it. And then do they also therefore not either have the time, the commitment, or the resources to start collecting that type of data, realizing what is now the infrastructure that's needed to collect this information? Are you having individual files uploaded to SharePoint and you have no historic record of that information? And it's just siloed off. Okay, now do you have the infrastructure of creating a data warehouse? I can have an ETL process of gathering all of this, right? So what infrastructure is there to help support that needed data? And then, just not recognizing, like I said, that the time commitment, the financial commitment, I think most of the time you're coming in and there is no AI or data solutions right now. And this is the first time you're actually deploying this type of machine learning model in your environment, and they expect a fully productionized result product.
Yeah.
It's really needing to say, hey, before you get all the way to a V1, like you're going to start off and it's going to be this information in a MVP, this is what we can deliver. And then with that commitment, continue on and do another 6 or 8 months to start building that out into a V1, but you're never going to go to a full versioned product. And if you do, it's going to be a very long time before anything is released.
Yeah.
Which is why we're like, hey, let's at least release an MVP for you. But we need them to really understand that. And so when they don't have a plan for continued development and they were like, we have 6 months for you to come in and create something, and then that's the end all be all, you're not going to have a lot of success. It's going to fail because you don't have a plan of, that's just going to be the first step. And then I want internally my team to continue to develop it, or we'll have some kind of renewal contract, whatever it is. They don't have that continual plan.
I know it's really hard. It's a fine balance, right? Because you talk to like salespeople and no, you don't try to tell them how much the whole thing costs. Otherwise they'll never do anything. And and until I really got into selling directly, like I didn't understand that. So no, we have to always tell them everything. What do you mean you can't? So I'm still trying to work through the balance of giving clients very realistic expectations and what it costs, but not scaring them with that so that they don't do anything. Because there's a danger if we say, try to shoot too high on what the costs will be, that they just get afraid and don't do anything, but it actually could create existential crisis or problems for them if they don't do anything. So it's like, how do you, it's an art still. I don't think ChatGPT is going to solve that for us.
Yeah, it is really trying to find what are the best ways to chunk up work so you can, because at the end of the day, of course, they want to see value. They want to see a change on their business. And you're a good data partner like that. You also want your clients and your customers to, great, we saw a business change. And so how can you chunk up the work so that it is a smaller financial, like digestible piece of, okay, for the next 3 months, I'm going to spend this much. And then in 6 months, they're going to submit something else. And it's going to be a little bit more. And so really starting to chunk that out, but realizing that at the end of each phase, really communicating the value that they got and that step that people are taking, as I always say, like in their AI journey, people are all on different paths. And so just, you're just going to take your next step and really helping them realize what step they took, even if what they got wasn't a technical solution, if it wasn't code. If we just gave you an AI roadmap, that's a step. You've started to realize, okay, these are business problems. These are the ways that AI can impact my company. And you're just starting to learn and educate yourself. That's an important step. But really trying to find that value of before they even commit to now, which one of these things on the AI roadmap do you need to do?
Oh my God. Yeah. So many. And then there's like the, then as you put on one of your last points, it's like that. I love how you framed it. It's like from white paper to deployment. So it's like kind of thinking at the, from the end, what does it look like if this thing is now living and breathing, the benefit, what does it look like to operate? So how often, like, what do you mean when you say that? Because I can imagine Amazon's famous for working backwards. So this is like a working backwards concept in a way.
Yeah. And I don't know if we've ever, speaking for all of Valkyrie, and I don't know if I see it from working backwards, but it's that there will be these, hey, there's this new research paper and there's new research that showed this. And there can be a lot of that comes out, but then we're, there's that gap of, okay, you guys have a lot of these research ideas, these concepts, maybe even, maybe a proof of concept, but maybe even whatever would be lower than a proof of concept. And so it's like, you really want people who are going to, who have a desire of really getting in and having actual change. You know what? I'm going to take the math from this paper and actually code it out into a real solution. And so I think the reason why people can get stuck in research cycles and just are like, oh, this is cool research, is they're just afraid of the risk that would happen if they are to deploy something. They know that it's going to be a complex procurement process. They're like, oh, we have to bring in outside people, and they don't have the, because they don't have the technical expertise in-house. So I think it's just a lot of cultural and organizational maybe resistance to coming out of a research type culture mindset of, this is cool research, to wait, we're going to actually try to implement what's in this paper. But just if they could just start with pilot programs, again, developing these clear success metrics for whatever their business problem, and then having these staged implementation plans to help walk down the risk of, okay, we're just going to take this step at this time. And that's something that Valkyrie has loves to do, was we found cool research and we're like, okay, yeah, but let's go build something out of that.
Nice. Okay. Awesome. You're starting to do some more public speaking. What else that could folks, they want to follow either some talks that you've given or want to reach out? What are some best ways for people to follow some of the activity that you're starting to get more and more into?
Yeah, just love to have people follow me on LinkedIn. I usually really post everything that I'm heavily involved with Code to College. So I'll do different speaking opportunities, engagements for that. Women in tech, I love to be involved in any of those types of initiatives. And Responsible AI is another thing I really love to speak about and just have a voice on.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you making some time today. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys.